Welcome to a very exciting edition of Blue Republican Radio. Some time ago, my regular listeners will know I did an interview with the chairman of UKIP, Mr. Steve Crowther. Now, one thing that is quite obvious to me is that Nigel Farage, the leader of UKIP, United Kingdom Independence Party, is probably the most famous foreign politician in the United States, certainly the most famous among the Liberty Movement. And I would say to many in and out of the American Liberty Movement, UKIP is just about the only political party that they're interested in that isn't American. And people who really are serious liberty activists in the U.S., many of us have an eye to what is going on in the U.K. with UKIP, because they seem to be a successful, insurgent, anti-establishment, liberty-leaning party, and perhaps we in the United States have something to learn from them. I did an interview, you can find it in the bluerepublican.org archive. I did an interview with Steve Crowther before, a few months ago, and I am delighted to say he's done me the honor of coming back on the show. And I'll say up front that it really is a bit of a privilege, because Steve Crowther doesn't do interviews outside England with journalists and media folks, so this is I hate to be cliche, but this is a bit of an exclusive. And so I don't want to do a long introduction this time, because we only have 45 minutes, and I think we might have a lot to learn from the chairman of arguably the most successful anti-establishment, insurgent, pro-liberty party in Europe. Steve Crowther, welcome once again to the show. Thank you for doing this.
Good evening, Robin. It's a great pleasure.
Well, thank you. It is always for me, too. Now, I said I don't want to hang about here. So the most interesting thing, or maybe the most important thing that has happened in UKIP, has happened for UKIP since we spoke last, Steve, and maybe symbolically at least, in the most important thing in English politics, has been that UKIP has got its first Member of Parliament. And I'm talking about, obviously, the British Parliament, not the European Parliament, where they won the European elections last time around and have many members of the European Parliament. They actually now have a sitting MP in the British Parliament. His name is Douglas Carswell. He recently ran won a by-election that had to be fought, because being an honourable gentleman who had resigned as a Conservative Member of Parliament, he stood up for re-election in his constituency of Clacton and asked the people if they would re-elect him under the UKIP banner, and they did resoundingly. Now, Douglas Carswell, many of my listeners will also know Daniel Hannan. He probably runs second to Nigel Farage in terms of the attention he attracts over here in the US. And for me, there's Douglas Carswell and Daniel Hannan in many respects are cut from the same cloth. And I might even say that Carswell qualifies as one of the few small-L libertarian parliamentarians that we actually have in the United Kingdom. And he, when he won his victory as a UKIP member of Parliament, I loved his speech, and I'm just going to read it. It'll take 1 minute, a piece of it. He said he advised his party that they practice humility when we win, modesty when we're proved right, and when we speak with passion, let it always be tempered by compassion. We must be a party for all Britain and all Britons. Our strength must lie in our breadth. If we stay true to that, then there is nothing that we cannot achieve. I loved that, because that's what I've been trying to say to what I do try and say in all my work to the Liberty Movement here in the US. To what extent, Steve, let's start with this. What does Carswell's victory represent for UKIP and British politics? And also, to what extent is Carswell representative of the direction that UKIP is going?
Well, it's gigantic, Robin, obviously, because we now have a member of the UK Parliament elected directly. And I think the important thing to remember is that Douglas was always known to be a man with views very similar to our own on the Conservative benches. His defection to us was not, I think, an enormous surprise, although it was a shock at the time. And I'm delighted to say Nigel managed it in such a way that so few people knew about it, that it was completely unspun and was a shock to the system. But what was really remarkable about it was that he, on the day that he defected to UKIP, said, "I am resigning my seat and putting myself up for re-election as a UKIP candidate rather than simply crossing the floor and taking new colours, because it is up to the people of Clacton-on-Sea, which is his constituency, whether or not they agree with my decision. And I think that was a measure of the man, who is a man renowned in Parliament for his integrity. And of course, he then turned a fairly enormous Conservative majority into an even more enormous UKIP one,
yes,
which was fantastic.
Yes. And what about this? You know, he seems to be distinctly libertarian. I know that he's written about, you know, his wish for a massively reduced state and all these kind of things.
Yeah.
Now, when we spoke before, you said we would do this interview again once UKIP comes out with its manifesto, and I don't know if it has come out with its manifesto, but obviously I'm interested in the intervening time. Is UKIP Carswellian or not?
Yes, it most definitely is, and I think, you know, you read a part of Douglas's fantastic acceptance speech on the night of his election, and it really summed up exactly how we as a party feel about ourselves. Inclusive, the humility and modesty and compassion values absolutely are what we see ourselves as. Now, it's not what we're always portrayed as or always seen as, but that is how we see ourselves. And Douglas is a forward-looking, modern man who believes that really the way in which government works now is old-fashioned and unresponsive and needs to be reformed.
Yeah, yeah. He's a true... He's a true libertarian and a true Democrat with a small d, in the sense of actually wanting representatives to represent and to push power down to the people who are supposed to be represented by them.
Yes, absolutely. And he's a great believer in using the modern communication channels to empower electors as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what about the fact that it seems... I mean, this is I'm kind of generalizing here, but it seems in many ways that UKIP has... A more of a political affinity with the right and more of a cultural affinity with the left, with the Labour voters. Talk to me. We've got only like probably 3 minutes in this segment, but let's start talking about that.
Okay, I can't really do it in 3 minutes. On the night in which Douglas was elected in Clacton-upon-Sea, previously a Conservative seat, we also managed to rather brilliantly lose by 617 votes in another by-election in the north of England, in the industrial north, in a Labour seat. We just very narrowly lost, which was a brilliant strategy, because the Conservatives have been using only one weapon on us now for some considerable time, which is if you vote UKIP, you will get Labour.
Yes.
And we are able now to say, well, in the north of England and the Midlands, if you vote Conservative, you will get Labour. So vote UKIP and we'll all be happy. It is certainly true that we are picking up huge numbers of votes from the working class in this country, who believe that the traditional Labour Party no longer exists, no longer represents them, and is effectively a sort of London-based liberal ideological think tank, which really has no relevance to their lives. And that's why we are getting this enormous groundswell of support.
You're benefiting perhaps then from the feeling among... people who would who traditionally vote left, who vote Labour, that Labour and Conservative, the two main parties, and I'm thinking of an analogy here with, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans in the United States, are really just two wings of the same bird, cut from the same cloth.
Yes, in a sense, that's half of the point, is that essentially our politicians have all been using electoral data analysis to find themselves walking down the same streets, talking to the same swing voters, and just trying to create slightly different flavours of the same answer to the question. But I think the other thing is, as you know from our last interview, I'm very uncomfortable with the whole left-right thing.
Yes.
Labels are difficult. There are an awful lot of old Labour voters who are deeply conservative in the way that they see the world. When I say conservative, I mean in its literal sense, not in its political sense.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, there are an awful lot of conservative voters who have quite liberal instincts. And, you know, once you start playing with that, you realize that those old labels don't really apply. It is to do with a whole new set of ways of looking at government and being governed. And I think what all of our supporters have in common is they think that government is looking after itself rather than them. It believes it is in charge rather than reflecting their will, and they are frankly fed up with it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, if this isn't resonating with all my American audience here, then I don't know what is, because you know this fed upness, this understanding that the left-right axis, that actually thinking in those terms has brought us to the mess that we're in. This is something that's certainly rising in the United States, and it seems that we have in common on both sides of the pond. We're going into the first break. Thanks for being with me, Steve Crowther, chairman of UKIP. We'll be back shortly. Welcome back to me to Blue Republican Radio with me, Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican, talking to the chairman of UKIP, arguably the most successful libertarian-leaning party, dare I say, in the world right now, Steve? Would that be... One of the most... arguably the most successful libertarian-leaning party in the world. Now... Steve, we actually discussed in our first interview, and I urge my listeners to go back to that interview and check, you know, go to the archives and pull it out if they're interested in what we're discussing today. One of the questions I kind of really pressed you on in the first interview was, to what extent is UKIP libertarian? Now, I'm not going to kind of really push it this time, but I do want to kind of talk about policy. And I'm just going to open this by letting my listeners know that UKIP plays down the labels. We were just talking a little bit about labels in the first segment. But if you go to the UKIP.org website, and I did this recently to check, you look at the party constitution, it says that it is a small L libertarian, small D democratic party. So Steve, where is UKIP now in its policy formulation? What are we going to be seeing in its manifesto? You can tell me if it's been published already. I didn't think it has. But I'm aware that we're coming up to... I mean, we're looking at a general election in 2015 in the United Kingdom. So So where are we politically? What are going to be some of the big policy, big policies or just kind of policy directions or tendencies?
Well, it's interesting. You said that that I said we would talk after our manifesto is published. We've gone through an interesting period because we, of course, over the last couple of years have come into the reckoning from being what was considered the sort of sideshow fringe party to being one that is now taken very, very seriously indeed and has consistently been polling third and sometimes snapping at the heels of the second party for a year or more. So people started saying, okay, well, hang on a second, what are your policies? We know you want to get out of the European Union and you want to control the borders of the country, but what else? Have you got any other policies? Now, that, of course, is a trap in as much as all parties release their manifestos in the run-up to an election when it's too late for the other parties to take them apart and steal bits. Interestingly, what we have done is we have trailed out essentially individual policy platforms and ideas, in particular at our recent conference in the north of England in Doncaster at the end of September, where we said, okay, these are broadly the sorts of things that we want to do. We will give you a fully rounded, fully costed, fully economically viable manifesto when the election comes. And that has been, I have to say, vindicating, because one of the things that we did suggest and trail some months ago, actually last year, was that we wanted to create a sovereign wealth fund out of the proceeds of the shale gas and shale oil that we now find that we have large reserves of here. That policy was in fact stolen by the Chancellor of the Exchequer on behalf of the Conservative Party this week. However, we have probably a difference of opinion about what we intend to do with it.
But he's going to want to build windmills and you won't? What are we talking about here?
One of the things, of course, we have a great advantage in UKIP is that we have for a long time, we've always been the champion of the cause that everybody else thought was mad. First of all, the idea that the European Union wasn't the most brilliant thing in the world. Secondly, the idea that controlling your borders and being able to manage migration inward and outward is a good idea. And thirdly, that spending billions, £18 billion a year on futile measures enacted under your Climate Change Act was also probably a bad idea, and that we would end up with, for instance, energy shortages. And for one of the top 10 economies in the world to be now admitting that it faces energy shortages in the next 12 months is really quite startling.
Well, indeed. So what can we, broadly, I'm not trying to preempt the specifics, obviously, of what you guys are going to want to put out for the election, but broadly, what can we expect in some major areas? Let's say taxation, welfare. I know, for example, Carswell, and I don't know if I've read this or somewhere, Carswell has written about massively cutting, his goal would be massively to cut the welfare state, which is something that I'm sympathetic with towards as a classical liberal. You know, I would like to see a greater civil society and obviously less statism. But it occurs to me that many people even who voted for Carswell would be shocked just to read, you know, out of context some of the things that he stands for as a classical liberal or, a libertarian or whatever. Those labels again. This is all shorthand, obviously, this is shorthand. But so bearing that in mind, bearing in mind that UKIP is Carswellian, but you have to bring along constituents who may not, who may not have read the classical liberal canon, who exist in a British politics that is about these labels, conservative, labour, you know what the mainstream media puts out in the way.
Well, congratulations, Robin, you just invented a new one. We are now Carswellian, and
it's kind of like that.
Defining Carswellian.
So where does this leave you? I mean, in terms of broad directions in policy, like, are you looking to reduce taxation? Are you looking to make it flatter?
We have made it clear that we believe that the reduction in taxation is an admirable goal. And the flattening of taxation is also an admirable goal. We do know, if you take the welfare area, one of the interesting things that has happened during the course of this parliament or this government's tenure is that a start has been made on sorting out welfarism, which has really condemned several generations of some families in this country to not having the expectation of work. And once that started, in fact, we found that huge numbers of people in this country really believe that is right. There is a great appetite in this country for reform of welfare and making it count where it's needed, but not making it something that distorts people's aspiration and ambition and ability to achieve. So that's where we would stand on welfare. Overall, the thing is that we have an economy here which is actually incredibly fortunate in that it's protected from being in the Eurozone and therefore has been able to fight its way back to the surface after its plunge. And that's important. But one of the things that is also important is that we should not leave the gigantic debt mountain that we have created and are still creating, because we're still in a deficit budget, for our children and grandchildren to pay, because that is irresponsible. And it's quite an interesting thing about UKIP, that it was born and maintained by people of an older generation who looked back and thought, hang on, this hasn't really worked out the way I thought it should. And, our age profile as a party, in common with others, but particularly, has been of older people. And one of the things that they has brought them together in UKIP and has made them power us forward is this idea that they cared what they left for their children and grandchildren. And that is part of our driving principle, is that we should be looking for ways in which we can actually go from deficit budget to a debt reduction. Now, that immediately calls from our opponents. And you're right, that's typical UKIP, want to cut things. They want to cut services. But we don't. We want to have an intelligent approach to the way in which the public sector provides. And when we produce our manifesto, it will be very well thought through, dynamically modelled to make sure that actually we are aiming for an ability to not saddle the next two or three generations with gigantic debts that will drag them under.
Now, the acceptance of that manifesto will, to some extent, depend on being able to perhaps to educate the British public, or a large fraction of them, in kind of your broader philosophy, in the principles that you're trying to apply, right? I don't know if there are a lot of... I mean, British politics is quite pragmatic. It's quite incremental.
It is extremely pragmatic, and I'm going to actually cut through you because it's the other way around. The British public have educated us.
Oh.
What UKIP is a reflection of the pragmatic, instinctual feeling of the ordinary man and woman in the country.
Steve, we're going into the break, but I want to pursue this when we get back.
Okay.
I love doing what I do. I get to speak to great people like Steve Crowther doing great things, like bringing UKIP to its to the successes it's having. And I'm learning a lot here. And I just said to Steve in the break, I'm super excited about what he just said at the end of this second segment, because I have been going around the United States in various conferences where I'm asked to speak. I get asked, the libertarian movement here look to me, because of what I write about and what my expertise is, they look to me to know how to become better salesmen and marketing men for their policies, for their philosophy. And I point to UKIP, and I say the reason UKIP has grown so fast and is having this kind of electoral success is because it's not trying to shove down the throats of an unready British electorate a whole new worldview, a whole like libertarian or other philosophy. What it's doing is it's just carefully reflecting back to the British people their own disaffection, being able to say back to the British people what it is that they feel, but none of the other parties in mainstream British politics can actually say. Now, Steve, you basically said that much more succinctly than I just did at the end of the second segment. So I would like you to tell us, talk some more about this, and if there are any libertarian or other, kind of anti-establishment, pro-liberty types in my country, my adoptive country, the United States, listening to this interview, I would like them to listen to you very carefully now.
Okay. Well, this is quite difficult, because if you start with a position and a strong political philosophy that you believe that everybody should see, but they haven't, then you're going to find this quite tricky, because UKIP actually only exists because we are the reflection of a sense of disaffection amongst the electorate. And I say the electorate, people, a lot of the people that vote for us now are people who haven't been voting. A rising and very large number, people who believe they have been ignored and effectively marginalized by the way in which politics is done. And this is why our issues are our issues. This is why the European Union was an issue. The political establishment, if you go back 20 years to when we were founded, or 10 years even, the political establishment, the media, every right-thinking person in the country would tell you the European Union was a good thing, a done deal, and our future.
Yes.
But the gut feeling within the population was, well, I don't really like the look of it. And that's how UKIP came about. And we are a reflection of essentially the political philosophy that exists within the population. Now, don't get me wrong, I do not believe, as Tony Blair once said, that he said that his party was the political wing of the British public. I think that was a startlingly scary thing for anybody to say, because not everybody believes the same things, and not everybody sees the world in the same way, and there must be opinion and counter-opinion, and there must be a balance between those things, and the differences of opinion are important, actually. But there are a lot of things that differentiate what we call the PPE class, the people who went to Oxford and did politics, philosophy, and economics, and then came out and went into the research departments of the political parties, and then did a job for a couple of years in a donor's PR department, and then went back to become an MP or a SPAD, special advisor.
Right.
You know, those are the people that are defining our politics these days, and they are so detached from the way in which people feel the way life is in their gut. That is how UKIP has arisen. So it would be ludicrous of us to say, right, this is our position, and we're going to try and ram it down anybody's throat. Our position is to take those feelings and those beliefs that we see within the population and the unrepresented population, effectively, the population with no voice, and give them a voice.
And just to kind of tie the different pieces of this together, do you think it's fair to say then that that broadly speaking, the British population, or a large fraction of them, have the gut reactions to current affairs that they do, to, you know, the big issues in British politics that they do, in as much as they are also kind of at their core broadly libertarian or classical liberal, you know, socially tolerant and fiscally responsible?
I think that is absolutely true, and I think the evidence bears it out. They are conservative with a small c, as I say. They are family orientated. They are patriotic. They believe in fairness, but they also believe that they should be asked how they're governed. I think that's one of the most fundamental things about why UKIP exists, is because what Europe has been doing is going through an experiment, or a long-term project, indeed, to turn us into a governed populace.
Yes.
The idea that was so cherished in our country, and we all have running through our veins, is that the government is there because we put them there, and if we get bored with them, we will take them away. And that is where the model, for instance, of the European Union went wrong, because they took the view that that was very dangerous, because the population could not be trusted to do that properly, and therefore the best thing was for the civil servants and the bureaucrats to be in charge of everything and to just have a semblance of democracy to keep the people quiet. And that is what our people have rejected.
Indeed, because our people, the British people, were the people that produced actually the beautiful distillation of this, which can be found in the American Declaration of Independence and Constitution, the explicit statement that all power resides in the people and is delegated only for the purpose of protecting the rights of the people.
Exactly.
Now, if you actually said those words as part of, a party conference in Britain, what kind of reaction would you get?
Oh, it would bring the house down in UKIP, but then bringing the house down in UKIP conferences is not difficult. We are the only people that actually have conferences that are worth going to these days.
Now, why do you say that? Because they're the only conferences that are actually interesting, where people are authentically themselves, or because... Go ahead.
We have conferences where we have real activists who come and actually listen to what's being said and then react to it, whereas the other parties have tended to go behind concrete walls where the delegates are carefully handpicked, and the idea is to give a film opportunity, a speaking opportunity to somebody to make a speech.
Okay, so that kind of makes me think of probably another area of questions that I want to ask you. When I was in England recently, I did see on the TV some news show a black gentleman representing UKIP. And it was embarrassing. I mean, I was really sorry that UKIP, who I kind of support, had this guy, I think probably damaging them in his lack of articulation and credibility. Now,
oh, no, Robin, no.
Tell me I'm wrong.
The guy you're talking about is Winston McKenzie. Winston is a good friend of mine. He is a lovely guy. And I have to say, Winston is not a professional in those circumstances, and that certainly comes across. And I love that.
Well, we all love that. But, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is there's a... Okay, so do you actually feel that... And if we're talking about the same interview, and he may be the same man, I don't know his name, that are you sure that it was actually beneficial for UKIP rather than not? Because I was kind of,
well,
I was kind of shocked.
Robin, I think you put your finger on something here, which is authenticity is more important than beneficial.
Say that again?
Authenticity
yes.
is more important than beneficial.
I agree with you in general, yes.
I as chairman of the party, I take the view and have said it before that if there ever comes a time when we go through a considerable period of time without making some sort of mistake or bumping into something, I will consider we are actually doing something very badly wrong because we will have become the others. And
Right. Okay, well, I like the sound of that. Now, I listened to only about 5 minutes of this thing, and I thought it was kind of evasive, actually. I didn't think it was authentic. I think if I thought it was authentic, I thought if it was direct, you know, Farage-esque, I probably would have felt better about it.
Well, you know, Nigel is who he is. He said in an interview, actually this week, you know, I want to change things, but I can't change who I am.
No, I'm saying we like that. I mean, I'm saying it's this chap I was watching on the TV, this black gentleman, didn't seem to have that. Like, at least Farage will always give you the direct answer to the direct question.
No, Winston, really, truly, Winston was being himself.
Okay, well, fair enough. Yeah, okay. So you didn't get any significant negative reaction in the media after that?
Yeah, plenty.
Okay, but then, okay, so to be fair, though, UKIP is always getting negative reaction in the media, and most of it isn't fair, right?
Mm.
So,
And some of it is. Some of that, you know, at the end of the day, you can criticise Winston. Why not? We don't have to be brilliant at everything.
No.
Representing the people. The people aren't brilliant at everything. And, you know, but sometimes things don't go perfectly.
No, absolutely. I'm with you 100% on that, Steve. But the reason I even mentioned it was to ask you this. Do you have the people and other resources to actually be able to put out the message?
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Do you have what you need right now?
Do you know what? Robin, this is a really, really key point. Yes, we do. But we also don't have a kind of massive meltdown when the media say, well, actually, we want to talk to Winston.
Right, okay, sure, yeah, good point, yeah. Yeah. So what is... I mean, what do you strategize? I mean, I guess you must as a political party in terms of a media strategy, public relations, or whatever it's called. To what extent? So, okay, we've talked about the fact that you are reflecting the instincts of the British public, and that is clearly why you continue to be so successful and at the rate that you are. To what extent are you nevertheless using the platform that you now have to tie together these instincts in to a kind of an overall philosophy? I mean, when you think, for example, of Margaret Thatcher, she was doing that. That was very much her politics. People called her a conviction politician. People were able to... They understood not only where she stood, but why she stood where she stood, right?
Mm.
So now...
I don't think... I have to say, I don't think that she was calculated in doing that.
No, I probably...
I think
probably...
she was simply representing what she saw and what she felt.
But she did have core beliefs. I mean, she put Hayek down on the cabinet table famously in that first meeting and said, you know, this is our Bible or something like that, right? you know, and I'm sure most of the British population don't know who or what Hayek is. I'm just really interested in... I mean, we've discussed, I think, UKIP's strength in reflecting back to the British people where they stand on certain issues, certainly reflecting back this sense of injustice, this sense of lack of control, that governance isn't self-governance. For example, in the United States, the libertarian movement or the liberty movement more broadly seem to me to be less good at that. But what they're good at in the US is actually when they do manage to do that, they situate it in in a broader perspective, in a broader worldview, and they do take the opportunity to educate in the worldview. Is that something that you can do in UKIP? Does that even make sense in British politics? Or is your kind of the driving philosophy something that is basically privately maintained and you only pull it out, you know, when you're asked for it, you know, like a gold watch? You don't show it just to show you've got one.
Gosh, that's a very difficult, complex question.
You're the man.
I think in some ways that is something that we are going to have to articulate over time. There are some key facets of what makes us who we are and why people are attracted to us. And that is that they believe that there should be less government interference in their lives, that people should take less money from them, and that they are people who believe that their nation is worth looking after and preserving, and it will look after them if they do. And in the sense of a wish to be able to carve your own life without a great deal of interference and dirigisme, if I may put it that way. Ooh, gosh, that's a political word.
You're on the right show. Go, go ahead.
So, but I'm loath to get over analytical about it, to be perfectly honest.
Sure. Robin.
And the reason I say that is because politics for me has always been a personal and amateur thing, and continues to be, and that's why we are who we are and what we do. Most of the people that lead UKIP and are important to it are not people that have ever set out to become politicians.
Yes.
Most of them. Not all of them, but most of them.
And that's why you are refreshing as a movement and a party in the UK.
It goes back to a more old-fashioned thing, I think, which is that we are doing this because we think that we have a duty to do it.
Yes. Yes. Oh, now there's a notion, hey? Doing something for the right... There's a notion. Doing something for the right reason, because you just have to, because it's what needs to be done. We like that.
That's what we are all here for.
Yes. Yeah. So now we've got 1.5 minutes only left in the segment. As always, you know, the hour goes super fast with you, Steve. Short answer to this question. What do you think the immediate future holds for UKIP?
We are extremely fortunate in that because of all of the things we've been talking about, we are actually reflecting reality. And therefore, what happens is that pretty much on a daily basis, the news headlines are acting as a party political broadcast for UKIP in pretty much any area you care to name. So the next thing that happens, I'm pretty sure, is that we're going to get our second MP next week.
Yes. This is another by-election, right?
We have another by-election. Mark Reckless in Rochester and Strood. Mark, again, is absolutely out of our political direction. And from there on, I think we just keep rising. It was predicted after the European elections that we won in May that our... vote share would then slump over the summer, and it didn't, and it has continued to rise, and in at certain points appears to be nibbling at the back of the two parties that consider government to be their right, namely Labour and Conservative. And I think we will continue with that trend. We will go on. We're demonstrating to the public here that you can actually vote UKIP and get a UKIP representative, and I think that makes a huge difference to the general election next year.
I love it. We're going into the final break. Thank you, Steve. We'll be back shortly. End of my show with Steve Crowther, chairman of UKIP, arguably the most successful libertarian-leaning party in the world. And I've learned a lot. I love this. I hope you've learned a lot too. Steve, this final segment is just a couple of minutes long, more or less. I want to ask you, you know, we have a general election coming up in Britain next year. Time flies. What does UKIP need to do between now and then?
We need to hold the tiller steady.
Okay.
It is quite clear that we have done the thing that we need to do, and we're about to do a little more of it in next week, and that is to show that voting in UKIP gets a result. In a first-past the post electoral system, it is almost impossible to break in to the hegemony of the first and second parties. The Liberal Democrats have been hanging on for 100 years as essentially the people that pick up the crumbs from the table. But breaking in and changing that hegemony is incredibly difficult, and we are doing it. And we are convincing people out there who see the whole political apparatus as not representing them that there is an alternative. And I think we just hold the tiller steady. We go into that election with a really strong raft of candidates, a candidate in every seat in the land, and we let people vote for us. And we put in front of them a series of policies that will very strongly reflect how they feel.
Yes, yes. Steve, thank you. I hope, as I say, that the Liberty Movement, that lots of folks in the Liberty Movement are listening to this, and that their kind of juices are flowing listening to you. I think we have a lot to learn from your successes over there on the other side of the pond. I'd also say to my listeners, I write about this kind of stuff all the time. I've written specifically about UKIP's success. I read an article, why UKIP? The answer is in history, not bigotry. And I urge everybody to read that, because one thing that happens to people who love liberty, who want to put governance down and back down to the individual, is they always get smeared with this kind of, you're a right winger, you're an arch conservative, you're cold and cold hearted. And we know that isn't true, but it's something that people who love liberty have to deal with in democracies all over the world, actually. It's not uncommon, and UKIP are doing that pretty well. Thank you for being with me. BlueRepublican.org. Come back next week.